Well, I hope you had a good and interesting day yesterday, and we're all set to have a great day today. So it's my great honor to introduce today's keynote speaker, Barbara Landau, who is the Dick and Lydia Todd Professor of Cognitive Science at Johns Hopkins University. Barbara's research focuses on human knowledge of language and space and the foundational relationships between these systems of knowledge. She organizes her research around key foundational, and that means really hard to test, questions such as what is the relationship between language and space? Do these differ across different languages? How do humans use each system to enhance the products of the other system? When and how do these two systems come to communicate with each other, and so on? Barbara has over 100 publications. Frankly, once I got to 100, I lost count. She has been continuously funded since 1981, and for those of you who are sleepy, that's 30 years. Receiving her support for her research from major funding agencies, including NSF, NIH, March of Dimes, and so on. She sits on numerous editorial boards and review panels, and is a fellow of numerous societies, including the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the Cognitive Science Society, and the Association for Psychological Science. She's also an accomplished administrator, recently appointed as Vice Provost for Faculty Affairs at Hopkins. In addition to these formal accomplishments, Barbara is recognized among her peers as a consummate cognitive scientist who is extraordinarily skilled at thinking across perspectives and discipline boundaries, and is well known for her ability to select just the right methodology for the question at hand, from a wide toolkit of methods that she has mastered across a range of domains that the domains that constitute cognitive science, including cognitive psychology, linguistics, neuroscience, and neuropsychology. Across her career, she has worked tirelessly to promote cognitive science, both as a past director of the cognitive science program at Delaware and as chair of the cognitive science department at Hopkins. And we are quite fortunate that she serves on the governing board for our society. Barbara has always been, throughout my career, one of my personal role models, and I believe she should be one of yours, too. So please join me in welcoming Barbara Landau, who will be presenting her talk entitled Language and Space, Momentary Interactions.
And I want to thank Laura for that very generous introduction. And I also want to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk this year. I'm really honored to be able to do it. And I especially want to comment that I think it's really wonderful that they chose the topic of space for the theme for the whole for the meeting. I think space is one of those unsung heroes in cognitive science that really has the ability to bring together people in different disciplines who use different methodologies, and I think it's comparable to language in playing that role. So today, the title is Language and Space, Momentary Interactions, and I want to tell you up front, I'm using space as a proxy for thought. Because I think that space actually provides a domain within which we can actually tractably test some hypotheses about the relationship between language and non-linguistic representations of the world, space being one of our primary ones. And I want to start by just mentioning some perhaps obvious things. Language and thought can be thought of in terms of two directions of causality. One is the idea that thought precedes language and supports its acquisition. So this is the idea that pre-linguistic primitives support the acquisition of language, especially spatial language, language that encodes objects and motions and spatial relationships around us. And this view is, I think, a pretty uncontroversial one, one that is embodied in theories such as Piaget's theory or Mandler's recent framework, which I think builds on that. Where's the pointer? Perhaps more controversial, however, is the question of whether language affects thought. And there are two ways in the field that people think about this question. One is the that learning a language at all, having a language, having a natural human language, changes non-linguistic thought. That is, the difference between a human baby and other species, let's say chicks and rats, is enormous in part because human beings have language. So that's one way of thinking about the question of whether language affects thought. The second way is thinking about people who learn language X versus language Y. Does learning a particular language change the way that we think about space? So this is, of course, very much the theme in cross-linguistic studies of the relationship between language and thought, where we ask if a person speaks language X versus language Y, do they represent the world in different ways in the non-linguistic system? And it's this latter set of questions, the language affects thought, that I'm actually going to be focusing on today. So does language change thought? Well, this graphic actually represents to me the way that the field is today. So, you know, we essentially are like a set of blind men exploring the elephant. So that some people say, the man who's exploring the tail says, yes, the elephant is something that's long and thin and, you know, very extended. The person who is exploring the trunk says it's very, very thick and wide and flexible, and so forth. So depending on what we frame as the question, what we think the question is, and what methods we use, we come up with very different answers. And in fact, the two answers that have come up in the field are language definitely affects thought, and language definitely does not affect thought. So those are two pretty radically different concepts. And, and what I'm going to argue is that we need to get a little bit beneath the surface in thinking about those two possibilities and get a little bit more refined. I want to turn to one currently prominent view, and I've got a lot of quotes here. I warn you in advance. I'll read through them, and the italics are mine in order to emphasize what this individual is saying, which I think is not an uncommon view in the field. So this is from an article by Guy Deutscher from the New York Times magazine section last summer, and it actually is echoed in his book, which was recently published, Through the Language Glass. So Deutscher says, when your language routinely obliges you to specify certain types of information, it forces you to be attentive to certain details in the world and to certain aspects of experience that speakers of other languages may not be required to think about all the time. Italics mine. And since such habits of speech are cultivated from the earliest age, it's only natural that they can settle into habits of mind that go beyond language itself, affecting your experiences, perceptions, associations, feelings, memories, and orientation in the world. Pretty strong position. But Deutscher quite reasonably continues, it's a nice idea, but is there any evidence for this happening in practice? And here he says, first, he appeals to experimental research that's in the literature, and says, ingenious experiments show that we even perceive colors through the lens of our mother tongue. The colors that our language obliges us to treat as distinct can refine our purely visual sensitivity to certain color differences. Our brains are trained to exaggerate the distance between shades of color if they have different names. He also points to a case in space that's quite a well-known case, a celebrated case. Speakers of geographic languages, that is, languages that commonly use terms like north, south, east, and west to encode spatial relationships, even those in the proximity of the speaker, have an almost superhuman sense of orientation. The language compels speakers from the youngest age to pay attention to the clues from the physical environment, the most intense imaginable drilling in geographic orientation. Your memories of anything you might ever want to report will have to be stored with cardinal directions as part of the picture. The evidence for this, by the way, is from a task in which someone is retelling a story. So it's clearly a linguistic task. Finally, Deutscher says, consequences of this view go far beyond what has been experimentally demonstrated, and may also have a marked impact on our beliefs, values, and ideologies. We may not know as yet how to measure these consequences directly, but we can do better than pretending we all think the same. Okay? Now, I want to ask what's wrong with this picture. Well, we can quibble and discuss seriously methodological issues, some of which I'll point to later, but I think there's a deeper problem, and that is that these kinds of inferences about the extensive effect of language on our thought, on our representation of space, for example, are too strong for the data that we have. More specifically, the evidence often comes from so-called non-linguistic tasks that could easily engage language, and I'll give you an instance of that in a minute, but many of the tasks in the spatial orientation domain suffer from this, and I think also some of the studies in the color domain suffer from this, and I'll point to those in a minute. Secondly, we have a poor understanding of the candidate mechanisms of change and how these might operate over development. I mean real mechanisms. And finally, most generally, the conversation is just too coarse. It's often just too coarse. That is to say, we can't be satisfied with saying, yes, it affects thought, or no, it does not affect thought. We have to go deeper. And so what I want to do today is discuss a new hypothesis, and that is language as a momentary mechanism. And the basic tenets of the hypothesis are that language causes momentary effects of modulating or directing attention, and these actually can be very powerful. The modulation mechanism is richly structured and depends on the representational format of language, both the syntax and the semantics. Its role actually changes over development, and it can lead to cognitive enrichment, but doesn't change our underlying non-linguistic representations. So the plan of the talk is this. First, I'm going to, as background, review two strong Whorfian hypotheses about how language changes thought in two domains. One is in the color domain. The other is in the domain of spatial reorientation, some of which we heard yesterday in the navigation symposium. Secondly, I'm going to go into the momentary hypothesis and spell it out a little bit more and give evidence from one selective case of language-vision interaction. And finally, I'm going to circle back and reconsider findings from the studies of color and spatial reorientation in light of this hypothesis, the momentary hypothesis, and I'm going to suggest it actually accounts for a big chunk of data in the field, so I'll extend it to other cases. So as background, I'll start with two strongly Whorfian hypotheses, and there are two different versions of the hypothesis that are currently circulating. One is the shaping of non-linguistic categories by learning a particular language, language X versus language Y, in accord with native distinctions. And the case study I'm going to consider for this is the case of color. The second case, or the second version of the language thought hypothesis, a Whorfian hypothesis, pertains to the possibility of that learning any language, having any language, provides a change, the mechanism for change. So this is the combining the output of non-linguistic modules, a hypothesis put forward by Hermer and Spelke, primarily Liz Spelke. And this is the idea that if you have a language at all, if you have a natural human language, you will solve a spatial problem, a reorientation problem, quite differently from the way that non-linguistic animals do this. So that'll be the case study of reorientation in space. So let me start with shaping of non-linguistic color categories and give you a little bit of background just to refresh your memory. I suspect that most people in this audience know this history. Whorf famously said in 1956, we dissect nature along lines laid down by our native language. Haider, or Eleanor Roche, she was then Haider, and Olivier in 1972, took up that hypothesis and looked quite seriously. It was the first real empirical cross-linguistic study in which they looked at the naming of color chips by the Dani versus speakers of English. And they also looked at their memory, the memory in the two groups. And they asked whether or not the naming, although the naming differences were quite large, the Dani have basically two basic color terms, English has basically about 11 basic color terms. They also found that despite these naming differences, the memory profiles of these two people for the same color chips did not differ. More recently, Roberson et al. Carried out some replications of Roche's findings, Haider's findings, and they actually argued that those findings were flawed methodologically, and they argued that using two different groups, English speakers and the speakers of Borinmo and New Guinea, that the very different patterning of the language actually showed up also in the memory tasks, so that Roche had been wrong to say that the naming patterns were independent of the memory patterns. Now, Roberson et al. Actually admit in a recent paper that many of the tasks that they used actually could involve language. So there are memory tasks in which one can encode something linguistically and then use that linguistic code to solve the problem and so forth. But they point to some recent tasks which they believe do not suffer from this problem. And this is most recently a series of studies by Gilbert and colleagues who ask, does the language we speak affect our perception of the world? And their quote, which I'll read to you, is, "Speakers of English judge colors that straddle the English category boundary between green and blue to be less similar than speakers of Tarahumara that uses a single word for these colors. Such categorical perception of color is eliminated under conditions designed to interfere with verbal processing, suggests that language may affect perceptual discrimination through the spontaneous but unspoken use of lexical codes. If so, these lexical codes are likely to be more strongly represented in the left hemisphere of the brain." Okay? So the way that they empirically demonstrate this, the data that they provide, is actually a visual search task, which Roberson et al. Feel is separate from any contaminating effects of language. And the task is this. Adults fixate across, and then they judge the location of an oddball. In this case, this is the oddball in this sea of other colors. And they judge whether or not the oddball is on the left side or the right side. And they vary the location of presentation in the right visual field or the left visual field. And I'll get to that, the findings on that in just a minute. Right now, it's important to say the structure of the contrast that they use are there are either between category contrasts, so there are items that straddle the line, the category boundary for individuals, in which one will be called green and the other will be called blue. And then there are within category contrasts, where they're both from the same within category for an individual. That is to say, a person would call these both green or call these both blue. Now, it's important to note that if you actually look carefully at the methodology, what you find is that right before doing the visual search task, Gilbert et al. Actually gave individual subjects categorical task in which they were asked to name the chips. And that was in order to determine where an individual's breakpoint is, where an individual's between category judgments stimuli would be optimal. So there's a naming task, and that's followed by the search task. So adults fixate, they determine, they judge whether or not the oddball's on the right and the left. And the main effect, there's a main effect of pair type. So there's faster reaction time when it's a between category pair than when it's a within category pair. And that's in a condition where there's no other interference at all. They're just making the judgment. So that's consistent with the idea that there certainly is an effect of being, of crossing a category versus being within a category. Gilbert et al. Also claim that the effect varies over visual fields. Now, what they say is that in the no interference condition, which is here, in the right visual field, when it's presented to the right visual field and hence projected to the left hemisphere, you get a faster reaction time for the between category pairs judgments than the within category pairs. And they also say that this does not happen in the left visual field. And then they add that in the verbal interference condition, where they're asking people to do a simultaneous visual verbal interference task, that between category advantage, which we saw over here, actually disappears. Now, what happens is the pattern looks like this, which is a little bit complex to understand. But in any case, the claim is that with verbal interference, the effect goes away. Okay? So you have the between category advantage in the right visual field, left hemisphere, and you also have that go away when there's verbal interference. The conclusions are as follows from Gilbert et al. The results of experiment one are consistent with the hypothesis that linguistic categories selectively influence color discrimination in the right visual field. For the visual search task, the Whorf hypothesis is supported most strongly, even exclusively, in the right visual field, projecting to left hemisphere where language is clearly. Whether language affects perception, post-perceptual processes, or both, any influence of language on perceptual discrimination clearly falls within the broad formulation of Whorf's hypothesis. Okay, so clearly they're claiming that there is a Whorfian effect, that it affects perceptual discrimination, that it only does it when it's presented to the right visual field and hence is processed by the left hemisphere, and it goes away with verbal interference. The summary of this hypothesis, then, is the particular language you learn, the lexicon shapes non-linguistic categories, perceptual discrimination. And the problem, though, is that most of the evidence, and I would argue even possibly the Gilbert evidence, comes from categorization, learning, memory, and even the search tasks that could easily engage linguistic encoding or recoding. Because remember that people were asked to do the verbal judgments before they did the search task. I think that the momentary hypothesis can explain these effects without invoking changes in non-linguistic categories, and that's what I'll come to at the end. Second case is combining across modules, the case of reorientation. This is the case of if you have a language, something different happens than if you don't have a language in a spatial reorientation task. This line of research involves a now very well documented phenomenon first discovered by Ken Cheng and Randy Galistow, in which they placed rats in a rectangular chamber. They hid food in one corner. There were various kinds of salient cues in the four corners. The rat was shown the food. The rat was then removed from the chamber, disoriented, and placed back into the chamber. And they were very surprised to find that the rat actually made very systematic errors. The rat would either search at the correct corner, or it would search at its geometrically opposite equivalent, the opposite corner. So in this case, if it's a rectangular environment, the geometrical equivalent of this corner is this one, because you have essentially the same relationship between the lengths of the two walls and their sense, the orientation relative to the body when you're looking into the corner. So this is long wall to the left, short wall to the right. Their interpretation was that this is a modular system, because it's ignoring all kinds of information such as odor, patterns in the corners, and so forth, and that this system analyzes the geometry of surfaces and is impervious to features, specific features like odor or visual markings that are not part of the geometric layout. This actually, for those of you who heard Neil Burgess's talk yesterday, this is very much in line with the importance of boundaries in rats and people's representations of environments. Okay, so that was in rats. Turns out that this has been extended and replicated and confirmed in many different species. So when this very same, when a human toddler or a pigeon or chick or rhesus monkey or a human adult is introduced into an all-black environment where the only information is geometric information, everyone from the time that you're about 18 months old on up tends to search either at the correct corner or at its geometrically equivalent corner, meaning that it suggests very strongly that people analyze the surfaces, the geometry of surfaces, and use them to reorient themselves. So if you see the toy hidden, you're taken out, you're disoriented, and then you need to search for the toy, you do so using geometry. It also turns out that use of individual features, such as, for example, a long red wall, or actually this is the short red wall, a red wall, is more variable and depends on context. So people have shown now, Nora Newcomb's group has shown that one can use the feature if one is sort of 24 months old, if the environment's large enough. But if the environment's a small environment, toddlers tend not to. It increases over development the ability to use this additional cue. And it depends very heavily on the particular context in which you're being tested. So the hypothesis was, in the initial thinking about this from Spelke, the question was, you know, human toddlers tend to show this strictly geometric pattern. Eventually, across all contexts, they come to combine with features. And so how do you go beyond the geometric system that's shared across species? And the idea was that there are two modules, a geometric module and a featural module, let's say, or two different